Hi. Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez is back again. I'm Ali Smalders.
I'm Rosie Sumner, sitting in for Laurie Harrison, who's in France this summer.
Last month, we had three people on this program: Mary Harris, her sister Joan Congdon, and their cousin George Higgins. All three of them grew up on the island from the 20s onward. Today we actually have somebody who came here in the mid-80s. But that too, I want to remind you, is almost 25 years ago. So maybe you already know about her because she has her own program on KLOI. Sue, you want to introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Sue Dumond. And as far as KLOI goes, I have a program called Gleanings. It's a music program that I call a multi-genre musical stew because I try to play a bit of every kind of music because my music taste is very diverse. And I also sometimes do something called the Dead Air Gypsies, which I call a spontaneous raggle-taggle group of gypsies live theater call-in show.
Wow.
It's fun. I really like it.
Great.
So, Sue, you want to start how you got to the island, how you ever came to the Northwest? Because I understand you came from the big city, Chicago.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Chicago area, and I did, you know, live a couple other places. But I like to think how I got out to the Northwest in general is from a child growing up in the late 60s, early 70s, and watching Here Comes the Brides on TV, which if anyone is my age era might remember that. It had the teen heartthrob at the time, Bobby Sherman. Was the main character, and it was set in Seattle, and that somehow made a very strong impression on me. I think maybe because I fantasized about the West, and we camped a lot as children in Wisconsin and Michigan, and I just from a young age had this idea that I was going to come to Seattle, and so I did make my way out here. First, when I was in college, I had a friend who came out to Lake Chelan, and they have these amazing work trades at a place called Holden Village. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a Lutheran retreat center up Lake Chelan, past 25 Mile Creek, and it's in an old copper mine and old buildings and stuff, and it's now and has been for a while owned by the Lutheran Church, and they have retreats there where people can, you know, come and, you know,
work trade
and actually stay there, and
they still do?
Yeah, I believe they still do. And so the staff is all work trade, and they have amazing workshops there. And it was a great way for me to get out west. And
did you drive, or how did you get there?
I took the Greyhound, and it was like it was like early 80s, because I remember Mount St. Helens just went off, and going through a lot of the ash in order to get to the area. And so anyways, I did a work trade there, and that's how I first came out here visiting, and I actually came out for 6 weeks. I think I stayed there for 2 or 3 weeks, and the rest of the time I hitchhiked all over the state and by myself, got into various adventures. And
so your friend told you about Holden Village? Because, you know, nowadays we think, oh yeah, I saw it on the internet, which you didn't, obviously. It was all word of mouth.
Yeah, it was all word of mouth. And
and how old were you right out of college?
No, I was my junior year in college. And I and so I must have been like 21 or something like that. And so when I was at Holden Village, a lot of the people I met after they were finishing their work trade there were going to go pick apples in Lake Chelan. That was the thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't do that because I had to go finish my last year at college. But I thought to myself, well, when I graduate college, I'm going to come out here and pick apples. And so basically that's what I did, which eventually led me to Lopez Island.
Did you actually pick apples?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Did you stay in one of those fake teepees that they had set up for pickers?
No. I had a completely different experience. I had the name of a couple orchard owners, and I wrote to one a very personal letter, you know, saying I was graduating from college and I really wanted to line up some work before I came out here, and told him about myself, and he said, come on out. And I got there, and the orchard owner decided that, you know, I was something to be protected, and had me stay in the house with him and his wife.
Uh-huh.
Which really was, I was really bummed out about that.
Uh-huh.
Because I wanted to have the adventure of apple picking and like meeting all the people who worked there.
Right.
And
you were not considered an adult, quite.
No, he thought because I was really the only woman in the orchard that, you know, he'd have to watch over me. And they were very Christian and they were very nice. But eventually I met a couple of the other pickers and they said there was a trailer that they thought I could stay up in, you know, around the other pickers. So I did. And I made some great friends. There were some, white Caucasian pickers and many Mexicans, and we all had a really great time. I didn't make much money picking because I wasn't very fast, but it was great. And then I ended up going to Seattle and stuff. So,
and so, how did you discover this particular island?
I had a friend who had come up here to visit, and there's a few directions I could go about telling that story, but Lopez kind of called to me in a few different ways. I met Patty Ward down at a rainbow gathering, because she was camping out with a friend of mine, and I also met Irene Sky River down there independently, but I had already heard of Lopez, and then when I got back to Seattle, this other friend said to me, oh, I have a friend on Lopez. And I said, oh, you know, I want to go up there. So we came up here together. And eventually a friend told me there was a place to rent up here. So I decided to move up for the summer.
And what year was that, Sue?
85. Yeah. I'm one of those people who moved up for the summer and stayed for almost 24 years now.
Wow. And you had finished college, and what was your main subject?
Photography. Yeah. So
when you got here, where did you live when you first got?
I lived in Outer Hooterville.
Can you explain to our listeners what Hooterville is and where Outer Hooterville might be?
Okay, Hooterville is down School Road, and now it does have a nice, glorious sign that says Hooterville, reputed to be that the name came when hippies would hoot and holler.
Yeah.
Huh. And
because they didn't have phones.
Yeah, they didn't have phones, and that was the way to communicate.
So they'd just go, hoot, 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 at their neighbors. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so my place was down the road, and so I referred to it as Outer Hooterville.
It was kind of across the road.
Oh, yeah. So you were living at Gerard Albanese's old place?
Yes.
Okay, and Gerard was also a photographer.
Yes, and that's, I found that really appealing. Because the house, when I came to look at it for rent, I ended up calling this house the Falling In Farmhouse, because it was, you know, the floors were all slanted, and there were some places where you could see the ground and stuff, so the Falling In Farmhouse. And then there was this shed where Gerard had put a dark room, very crude dark room. it had a, like a mattress, you know, like a hammered to the wall for insulation. Mm-hmm. And it was, I ended up never making a dark room in there. I did clean it up with the intention to, but I ended up putting my dark room somewhere else. But that was the house, the Falling In Farmhouse, Outer Hooterville.
And weren't you telling us that in those days, everyone who did have a phone was on a party line? So was that the first time that you had to deal with party lines?
Yeah, well, I didn't have a phone for a few years. And so, but when I did get a phone, and everyone around us had a phone, we had party lines, and there were four people on the party line, at least
in
my.
And you knew who they were.
And I knew who they were.
And you could hardly get on, right? Because some of these people were kids, and some were talkative.
Yes.
Correct? We won't name names here. But.
Yeah. I think probably everyone had their own issues with their own party lines.
Right.
But I did. It was four of us, some people were more talkative than others, and my particular issue at times was that someone's phone would get knocked over by the chickens.
Because the phone was kept outside.
It was kept outside. And so I
no one
I'd pick up the phone and hear the chickens in the receiver.
So then you'd have to go over to Inner Hooterville and go and hoot and tell them to get the phone out of the chicken yard.
I tried hooting in the phone, but apparently I didn't do it loud enough.
Only the chickens heard.
Yeah. So I'd have to walk up the hill and hang up the phone. But, yeah, so.
Chickens thought you were a funny-looking chicken.
Yeah, so.
So, and how did you get around in those days? Did you have a hippie van or a bicycle?
Oh, I definitely had a hippie van.
Uh-huh.
I had several hippie vans. The more it broke down, the happier I was. Kidding. But actually, I learned how to fix it. So.
Oh, that's great. And so, when you were here, when you moved here, You were pregnant with Alia, is that correct?
What ended up happening is I moved here for the summer. I did not realize I was pregnant until I moved here. And then turned out I was. And I realized, you know, that if I was going to be anywhere and have a baby, this should be the place. Because it was pretty clear from the start that I would be a single mother, and with my particular situation, and I kind of, you know, I was new to the island. I looked around and there was a lot of wonderful parents and kids, and at the time there were several single mothers that I had become friends with who helped me to really see that I actually could do this thing. And not only could I have a kid, but I would actually be okay having her alone if that's the way it was going to be. And when I think back on it now, I realize it would have been so different if I had tried to parent her somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't just mean in you know, helping, but I guess just emotionally feeling safe and able to do things here. Mm-hmm. And
like a reassuring environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, you told us a great story about being somewhere with Alia when she was little and she was having a hard time and you were trying to paint and Bauer reassured you.
Oh, yeah.
And made you feel like, could you tell us that little story?
Oh, yeah. Well, so after I had Alia, my daughter.
How old is she now?
She is 23 now. And
so you and I were pregnant at the same time?
Yes.
Because Kiba's 23. Yeah. I think I remember that. Yeah.
We were part of all the, you know, babies all in a row there.
Right.
Remember us getting our pictures taken?
Yes, all our pregnant bellies.
There was about, if we really started to list them.
There was Sorrel and Tui, who doesn't live here anymore.
But we've got to back up a little bit.
Okay.
Nick Moody.
Oh, okay, we're doing babies. Okay.
Yeah. Nick.
So Margaret.
Yeah, Nick. Then Sky.
Yeah,
then,
Tui's baby.
Then Kiba.
Uh-huh.
Then Arl, David.
Wait a minute, what about Rowan?
Rowan.
Because Rowan was born before Kiba.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why our midwife wouldn't come out anymore because of Rowan's complicated birth.
Right.
And then Kiba and then...
That's what I mean, right?
No, that's Robin.
Oh, and then...
Robin's older.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Robin's
yeah,
older.
Robin's older.
And then... So then after...
A bunch of boys. Was Alia
It was
the
a bunch
girl?
Of boys. Alia was the girl who turned the tide.
Oh, right.
There
okay.
was a bunch of boys in a row. In fact, her first present was from Irene Sky River, and Mark Minkler brought her a little shirt that said, I'm not a boy. Because she was the first girl. And then right after her was Laurel.
Oh, yeah.
And then the twins...
Holly's twins?
No, Lori and Jerome's.
Oh, yeah.
Elena
yeah.
and Josh.
And her brother, right.
And then, yeah, and then there was like Molly.
Brooke? No.
No.
You mean Molly Fisher?
No, Molly Huggins.
Oh, yeah.
But there was
okay,
a little
Kathy
gap in there.
Voice.
Anyways,
right,
lots of babies. As always on the island.
Fertile island.
Lots of babies.
It's the sheep. That's what I was always told.
So, and we all got our picture in the paper because there was such a crop of babies that they took our picture. And but yeah, so I...
So back to your feeling okay about being a mom, a single mom on Lopez.
Right. Well, I... story is okay, so I have Alia, and at the maybe she was about 6 months old or something, I think it was around that time, I heard there was a place to rent up at Pat Cunningham's that I could use for a dark room because I didn't want to use the one at the Falling In farmhouse. It was just not up to my standards as a photographer. I'm sorry to say, Gerard, you made your best effort, but it was not up to standards. And so I rented a little place there. I think it was like maybe $25 a month. It didn't have running water in it, but you know, I would bring in my trays and I started doing photography again. And I'd, you know, have someone, you know, here and there, you know, watch Alia while I could do this. And at the same time, there were some meetings going on about starting a cooperative art gallery, which eventually became Chimera. And I went to the very last meeting of that. I guess they had met three or four times about it. And Bill and Florence Burke were the real spearheads, and everyone else was like me, kind of like, broke hippies. And
so explain who Bill and Florence were.
They used to own the Islander. They were both artists, but they were very savvy business people.
Oh yeah, Bill was a photographer, wasn't he?
He was a photographer.
Was he responsible for all the tiki decor at the Islander?
I'm not sure. Because that precedes
me. That already existed in 71.
Oh,
when we came.
Yeah. So... They were very much the spearheads because they had, business experience. And the rest of us, I remember going to the meeting and everyone was very scared of, you know, taking this leap and because we were going to all rent this space and each put in the same amount of money and work the same amount of hours, and it was just extremely scary. And they needed like one more person, and I showed up to that meeting and I was like, yes, mm-hmm. you know, though I didn't quite know what I was saying yes to. And so I remember our first, you know, so I have this little baby. I'm trying to do a little darkroom work and still try to be an artist. I've said yes to this this cooperative art gallery, whatever that is.
Was it named Chimera right away?
No, we had a couple meetings about that. I remember one of the possibilities was the heart attack.
What? Really?
Yeah, the heart, or no, the art attack.
The
art attack. That's the only one I remember. But Chimera was Pamela Marsden's suggestion,
mm-hmm.
because she thought we were a many-headed beast, or
what
is a chimera?
Word? I don't know. Is it a Greek word?
It's like it has the head of, I think, a lion and the tail of a dragon, and, you know, it's multi-parted. And so we all thought that was a great idea.
And now everybody is used to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so then we had, you know, to get the place ready, and we had this painting party that I showed up for, but I had this, you know, little nursing baby, and I showed up ready to do work, and I got there, and of course she was crying and having a fit, and I was just trying to, you know, be an artist and you know, also try to make a living and stuff. And I was so frustrated that I couldn't help that I just broke down in tears. And Diana Bauer was the only one there, and she was so comforting to me and said, "Oh, honey, it's okay. You know, you just do what you can. You know, you just take care of that baby." And all this, and it totally bonded me to Diana forever, you know. And
that's great.
And it all worked out. I mean, I participated in the gallery, and I also brought Alia a lot there when I watched it.
And what did you sell at the gallery?
I sold photography, black and white photography, and then I started doing some postcards.
I remember those postcards. I would like you to describe a couple of those postcards, because they were very unique, and I for one loved sending them off. They really
great.
Represented the part of Lopez that appealed to me.
That's great. I started, actually Irene Skyriver helped me with some of the ideas. She said to me one time, because she's part Native American, we started talking about the Edward Curtis photos. And if you're familiar with Edward Curtis, he photographed a lot of Native Americans. But he also, what he did in that is he didn't always represent them in their real Native attire. He dressed them up in, you know, what he thought looked good, not necessarily their particular heritage. And then he'd also, like, you know, pose them in some of the ones having in cars, because he thought that was funny, you know.
I had no idea. This is an education.
Yeah, well, a lot of his photographs are very romantic.
Mm-hmm.
But they
the ones too where you'll see the chief in all his regalia with his wife all dressed up next to him, sort of formal,
mm-hmm.
but they aren't wearing their...
Well, they're not pure documentary.
Gotcha.
You know, they're not really... That's the thing about him. They're
mm-hmm.
they're staged,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not really, you know, correct historical. And then there's those other parts that where he... you know, where he show him in car, because at the time that was like funny, oh, you know,
mm-hmm.
haha. So,
I wonder if that's where Geronimo's Cadillac came from. I always wondered where the title came from.
It could be. Yeah. So, so Irene said something like, "Oh, you know, we should do like a modern version of those, like local native digs clams, and you know, have a boombox sitting there while a native is just, you know, digging for clams." And I was like, "What a great idea!" You know, so that was like the first card I took. You know, I always had a sense of humor, you know.
Was it Irene who was the clam digger?
Yeah, Irene was the clam digger, and it has her on McKay Harbor, you know, with a stick digging for clams, and she has, you know, some scant attire on, and there's a boombox there. Uh-huh. And so then we started, you know, working on the series. She was in every one. We started talking about, he has a famous photograph called The Tool Gatherers, you know, and where he shows Native Americans in a canoe gathering reeds and, you know, tools, T-U-L-E. So we were like, tools, T-O-O-L-S. So we took Greg Blomberg's canoe that he had carved out, you know, hand carved out, and we put it in his pond, and we planted, you know, a shovel and a rake, and we put it in there. And so we staged our own photograph and took a couple of Greg's masks out there, and we had a little raven in there, and Leslie Redtree. And so that was another card. We did a bunch of them. Not every one did I end up get printed commercially. We had the local natives at summer camp. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but we have like a dome tent and a TV. And too, I was always really concerned that people would maybe take the cards wrong as like a slam on Native Americans, which wasn't my intent at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it was more kind of a, how we romanticize Native Americans as white people, mm-hmm. you know, and how we often, you know, like they say, Native American wannabes and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But, you know, I only once or twice encountered people who took those particular cards wrong, you know. And
art is often controversial. That's part of the charm of it, don't you think?
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Do you still have samples of these cards?
Oh, yes, I have lots of boxes.
Yeah.
I wasn't very good at marketing myself back then, but I also realized that it was because I had a small child, and it was hard for me to figure out how to sell them outside of the island. Whereas now, you know, we have the internet and stuff, and actually some of the a lot of the paid work I have been doing in the last few years has the title of marketing, which is kind of funny to me.
So you've really learned to market.
Yeah.
Well, Ollie is all grown up now, so she's not in your way. I'm sure she's probably a good cheerleader for you in your art endeavors.
Yep. Yeah, she definitely is. And there was a certain point where, you know, I kind of stopped doing art because I had to work more and in order to take care of her and also to support her art as well, which, you know, she's pretty artistic too.
She sure is.
So now's my time again.
Right.
Right. Kind of take turns.
Yeah.
How old was Alia when she started to make things herself?
Oh, she's was always making things.
Yeah, I remember.
I have a picture that she drew of Kiba, my son. She did this little drawing of him in class, and somehow I got it, and it's a treasure to me. Alia's portrayal of mm-hmm. Kiba.
Yeah.
Very, very talented.
Yeah, she really got into it, too. Like, I had her, she started the Alia Dumont Card Company, or I helped her do that. She did Christmas cards, and then we made the coloring books every year. I don't know if you remember those, but
I still have some of her Christmas cards.
That's nice.
I remember when she used to make movies too.
Oh yeah, yeah. She's still making movies too.
Yeah.
She's a really good writer too. So.
And theater.
Yep. Yep.
So tell us some more about other endeavors that you had.
Other endeavors.
Well, like I was thinking, you know, we all know that to make it on Lopez financially, if you haven't come here as a retired person and already have your funds set up, it's you mm-hmm. often have to wear many hats.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So can you tell us about some of the hats you've worn trying to, you know, put food on the table?
Definitely. Well, you know, when Alia was younger, under the age of five, I worked a lot in the fields around here. You know, I think that work is still available around here, but not the way it was back then. I worked for Gary and Alberta Franco. Mm-hmm. I worked in their fields a lot.
What was the crop?
Strawberries, all sorts of berries. Boy, they really, you know, they really had it going on there for a while.
And bulbs, probably, too.
And then tulips, worked in the tulip harvest. I worked there several years in a row. I also, actually, even before that, when I first got on the island, I worked at the Fogged Inn.
The Fogged Inn. Which, that was at the ferry.
At the ferry.
At the ferry landing.
Right.
Yeah. When Joy Lutz owned it. And when I happened to, here's a little tidbit, when I happened to move to the island, it was right in the midst of the Ruth Neslin trial.
Mm.
Uh-huh. And so I worked at the Fogged Inn, and there are a lot of people, especially, you know, working guys, were, you know, riding the ferry and transporting, you know, things. As they'd come and have coffee early in the morning, because I would work there at like 6 in the morning, and they were all talking about the trial and this, that, and the other thing, and all sorts of theories and stuff. But I was so new to the island that I heard it all, but I had no idea who the cast of characters were they were talking about.
And so that was in like 1985?
1985.
Yeah, because when I moved here in 78, very soon after that was when, it must have been, that trial must have been long, because mm-hmm. I remember having the same reaction as a new person here thinking, oh my God, this has got to be a joke, this whole murder thing that they think happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On and on.
I heard all the meat grinder stories.
Yeah, me too.
And all that. But the thing is that I heard so much stuff. And not just about that, but, you know, just the island grapevine gossip. But I didn't retain any of it because I didn't know anyone.
Uh-huh. And probably a good thing, too.
I know it probably is.
Half of it wasn't true anyway.
It's just amazing to me how much I remember just all the talk. So I did that, and then when Alia was little, worked in the fields, used to put her in my Volkswagen bus when she was sleeping, drive over to Gary and Alberta's. You know, she'd be asleep in the van, I'd keep the door open just a little bit, and then as soon as she'd wake up, you know, she'd toddle out in the fields. You know, and her and Lucas would, you know, run around all day.
That's Gary and Alberta's son, who's now a huge, strapping fellow.
Yeah.
Oh, right. He was one of the babies born around that time, too.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. One more.
Yeah. And so I did that. I also worked for Daryl and Becky in the garlic harvest. And there was one garlic harvest that went pretty much all year.
Wow.
Because we were working. They had planted so much garlic that we spent the entire winter cleaning the garlic and boxing it up.
Wow.
It was an immense harvest that year. And let's see, when Alia was in kindergarten, I saw an ad to be a bus driver.
Oh, I remember that. I remember now, you were a bus driver.
Yeah. Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah.
And when I saw the ad, I thought, you know, school bus driver, I've been driving around a van. How different could it be? I have one kid in the van. It wouldn't be that different to have a long bus with lots of kids. So, and I knew I was a good driver, so I applied, and I also thought, well, I'm a single parent, you know, what can I do around the island here with, you know, not, I don't have another parent to hand her off to, and you know, how can I really, you know, work this? And I thought, well, working at a school would be great, because then we'd have holidays off together, you know, that kind of thing. And so that was, you know, some of my thinking in applying for that. And so I did, and I got it.
Uh-huh. How long did you drive bus?
Like 13 years.
Isn't that funny? Because wasn't Alia in school about that long?
Yeah, well, I did. I quit the year after she graduated.
Yep.
And when she was in kindergarten, back then they had two bus routes going. Now they combine everyone on one route because they...
takes a little longer for them to
or
get
wait,
home.
Do they do that now? I can't remember. But back then the school started earlier for the different grades, middle school and high school, and then the elementary. But as I remember it, I used to have to leave my house at 6 a.m. Mm. And so I would have to pack up, you know, my sleeping kindergartner and put her on the bus, you know, around 6:30 I would start my route, something like that. And she'd fall asleep and I'd drive the first route and then I'd drive the second route where I was picking up the elementary, and then I'd have to wake her up to start school at 9. And I mean, she's a little trooper, because I mean, really, every job I took, including in the fields and the time I put in at Chimera, she had to come along with me, because you know, I had other parents to trade with. But you know, if anyone else who's a single parent knows, that, you know, that isn't a daily reliable thing.
Right, especially at 6 a.m.
No, I absolutely had no one I could do that. And so a lot of my jobs I took and stuff, I had my thinking, what can I do that I can do with her? And so, I mean, she was a trooper, and she was always pretty beat, of course, when she started kindergarten. And somehow I got food in her before she started school in the morning. I can't quite remember how, but I did feed her. So, you know, and then I at first I was a sub, and then it became more of a full-time job, and then I did some other things at the school as well. But yeah, so I was a bus driver.
And I remember in recent years you were the, what did you call yourself? You took care of some of the noxious weeds along the...
Oh, the weed wench.
The weed wench. That's right. I like that title.
Yeah. I started doing, you know, and I started doing some of that stuff when I was a bus driver, because bus driving doesn't give you enough hours really to... get by on. Mm-hmm. And every bus driver knows that. And so you either, I filled in by working in the kitchen at school, or and also doing some landscaping on the side, or actually not landscaping, more chainsawing and stuff. And then I heard there was a contract offered to pull Scotch broom along the roadsides, and so I applied for that contract and got it. And someone suggested to me that because I used a weed wrench to pull out the weeds, that I should call my business Weed Wench. And I thought that sounded great to me. So that's what I named my business, Weed Wench. And it's always funny to me, I actually still sometimes get phone calls from solicitors who call me and say, is the weed wench home?
The weed wenches home, but that doesn't work anymore in that field.
So I'd like to change the subject for a minute. I mean, you're welcome to say other occupations you've had on Lopez when they occur to you. But speaking of that name and your sense of humor, Sue, one thing that you've always delighted the female population with on the island who attend the yearly coffee house, you have had a reputation for coming to the coffee house, which usually happens sometime in the winter when we're really needing to be entertained, and you would bring special offerings, and I can't remember when you started doing this, but I know that we always look forward to your contribution. Can you talk a little bit about that and what inspired you to do what you did?
I remember early high school
diaries.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Well,
were you involved in starting the coffee house?
No. Sorrel North and Nancy Bingham.
Wasn't it Tui also? I thought she was in the very beginning.
It was really Nancy and Sorrel who started it, but Tui's been involved. Mm-hmm. I went, actually my first coffee house I went to, I was 8 months pregnant with Alia, and I read from my teenage diaries, and anyone who looks over their teenage diaries, if they can't find humor in that, then something's wrong. And so I read them, and very theatrically, and so started a trend in that way, mm-hmm. of at least for my performances of for at least a few years. I read from my teenage diaries, then I got into because I collect a lot of different things, odd books, and I do have a sense of humor. I mean, I've talked about the cards and stuff, and I had a habit of picking up books with odd and interesting titles, or things that were, you know, no longer of our era,
right,
that are so out of date that they're funny. So I would read them at the coffee house, and then...
Any outstanding examples of a book? I remember we used to just be doubled over laughing, and we could not believe that you would actually find a book with these, with some unreal title.
Well, like How to Be a Roadie, The Psychology of Normal People, let's see... And all of, like, self-help books,
right,
especially any self-help books from the 40s and 50s.
How to Be a Good Housewife. And
yeah.
Then you read excerpts.
Yeah.
Like, always greet your husband at the door with a clean apron on or something
like
that.
Yeah. Very appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The How to Be Cool book. You know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Great.
And were you always into music, or did that come at a certain time that you turned into playing yourself and being really interested in?
I've always been interested in music. My mother was a piano player, and my grandmother was a singer, that kind of thing. And I wanted to play the drums, but I was forbidden because I know it's so sad. It still scars me.
Yeah.
And
Why were you forbidden to play the drums?
It was too noisy, probably.
Too loud.
No, because
you were a girl.
Because I was a girl. I was told,
really?
Because
we
I was a girl.
A trap set.
I know. I'm telling you. I'm still like, think about it.
Oh, that never would have occurred to me.
No, it was the late 60s. And now I think to myself, especially when I see women who are like my age, and somehow in my family that was not okay at the time. My mom is really sorry for that.
Yeah.
They did give me a pair of bongo drums, though, which I beat to death. But I ended up being switched to the guitar, which I did enjoy, and I played for years and years. And I took lessons at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago, which is like an infamous place. And and it still is just the greatest place to learn and see music.
Why is it infamous?
Because there's just, Chicago has such a rich folk heritage, and the way they run their classes there. I would go on Tuesday nights with my friend Renee, and we would drive down there, and they would teach these group classes, and then at the end of the night, of different levels, you know, I'd be in a certain level, and my friend Renee was very advanced, still is. She's a professional musician, and at the end of the night, they'd put all the levels together, and then we'd play songs at our ability together. And it was just, it really was, I really learned a lot that way. And they're just very supportive place. And, you know, and I continued to take lessons after that, too, and stuff. But I also listened to a lot of music, of course, you know, like any teen. I got really into the Grateful Dead and, you know, traveled and followed them around. And so I've definitely always been a music lover, and I've go to a lot of festivals and have many musicians who are friends. And so, you know, and presented concerts here in the island, you know, years ago, but only here and there.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Huh.
Remember, I did, like, back in the, let's see, like early 90s, I did, but I only did Alice's shows because mm-hmm. she was a friend of mine, mm-hmm. or had become, she had become a friend of mine. I actually met her in the Grange, which is funny to me now because we've been such longtime friends. But did a few back then, and then recently I've been on a crazy roll for the last few years and started producing the Home on the Grange shows.
At the Grange.
And
what does the bumper sticker say?
Don't be a stranger, be a Granger.
It's a great bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Very good one.
Yeah. So, I started those because I just kind of felt like when I first got to the island, the Grange and the Legion Hall were used a lot. We had some really wonderful events there. And, you know, over the years, things changed on the island. The community center got built, and then, you know, the Grange and the Legion Hall, you know, now Woodman Hall, both needed repairs and weren't being used. And then when the Grange came back in use, you know, things had shifted and it wasn't being used. And I felt like I wanted that intimate experience again that we had there. So I had my first show like 3 years ago with Danny Schmidt and Esther Galton, and things just kind of snowballed and went out of control ever since.
Hard to keep up with.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Now it's maybe becoming the thing as a musician to have a gig on the south end of Lopez Island because of Yuzu.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. Seems like, I mean, everyone who's played there has so enjoyed it, you know. It's the place, it's, you know, the people. And
you don't make any money at all doing that, do you?
No.
Plus you give them a bad business, a place to stay.
Labor of love. Yeah.
But I am working on, I mean, you know, some things. It really did kind of snowball and go out of control. And Lopez, as you know, when you present events, sometimes it's not always really reliable. Mm-hmm. Who's going to show up? You know, we don't have as many people to draw on. But what I feel like is that I have created something that has grown, and people have are kind of trusting in my sense of musical taste is the only way I can put it without sounding too egotistical, mm-hmm. or something, mm-hmm. I hope. But that they know that I'm bringing some good stuff and want to come and see it. And that's really kind of increased the volume of people who are coming there. Because mm-hmm. I think some people, I mean, for me, because my music thing is like, I'll go see anything. But some people, if they don't know the names, they won't go, mm-hmm. or something. But what I've been finding is a lot of people tell me that they go, oh, well, I haven't heard a lot of these people, but I know you, you know, bring some good people, so I'm just going to keep going, you know. And I really enjoy that, you know, that I've turned people on to some really good stuff and that it's new stuff to them.
Can you tell us who's coming in the next year or so? Do you have any people you know?
Yeah, I have Jim Page. Seattle's Jim Page. You know, very topical singer-songwriter. I have Deadwood Revival at the end of July.
They've been here before, haven't they?
No, I don't think they have.
Oh, okay.
They're from Port Angeles. Mm-hmm. That's probably where they've played a number of festivals around here. And then I have Boulder Acoustic Society. They're from Boulder, Colorado. And then Foghorn String Band. And they've been here before. And Caleb Clotter, who's in the band, grew up on Orcas Island.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Well, I have a feeling that, you know, the community center and the Grange both can exist beautifully next to each other, because there are different kinds of programs that are performed in different places. And eventually, now that Woodman Hall is just about ready to open again, that will probably get its own place too. Because as we get more people, there is more of a desire to have certain kind of programs that don't always fit in the community center or don't always fit in one
right.
of the others.
Different
yeah.
atmospheres.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. It's yeah. they can all work. And I'll just add maybe one more thing. Actually, my biggest thrill was having a few of the Grange members show up at my show on Valentine's Day this year.
Actual Grange members.
Yes, actual Grange members, old timers.
Yeah.
I was...
who was performing then?
It was Cindy Callett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Gray Larson.
And Gray Larson. That was a great show.
Because I mean, to kind of bring it to Once Upon an Island is like how you started out the show about how you've been interviewing people from who grew up on the island and stuff like that. One of the things when I first moved to the island, I did have a couple of, you know, where I was like a young hippie and I rubbed up wrong against some old timer on the island. And it was very upsetting to me, because I really wanted to know these people and hope that they like me, you know, because I felt like, wow, they're so amazing, you know. So like when I was first doing the Grange shows, I think I was a little skeptical of me, you know, because they had just painted the Grange and done all this amazing work, and it's such a historical building, and the folks who are involved in the Grange, a lot of them, their grandparents were involved in the Grange. So it's like very important and to them and to all of us in this community. To me, it's like really like just, you know, I don't know quite how to say it, but
it's like an honoring of the heritage.
Yeah, it's like, well, like Danny Schmidt wrote a quote, I have it on my website, and it says something about how the Grange Hall is hammered together by planks of old stories.
At one time, the Grange was called Center School. And to me, that is so amazing that it was called Center, because it doesn't seem center to us. But Mary Harris mentioned that several times. Oh, yes, that was Center School.
Yeah, so, I mean, I just feel really... just glad that we all can use that place that has been so much a part of the history of this island. And you know, when I started doing these shows too, Bob Burt did a lot of work there. And I started talking to Vivian Burt, and she was telling me the things that they used to have there and the kind of music and stuff. And, you know, and I just feel like we need to continue that in those places mm-hmm. as well. And I just felt really honored, you know, and in this past, you know, when Bob and Vivian were sitting there and, you know, listening and the smiles on their faces, you know, that they could be in the building, you know, Bob Burt's grandfather built that place.
Wow.
You know, and that they could be here mm-hmm. experiencing it, you know, and just, we just have to keep the buildings alive, you know, too. So
yeah.
Anyways.
Kind of connect the old and the new.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're just about out of time, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And is there anything else? I mean, we haven't even mentioned your skills as a computer expert. I know you're working at the Family Resource Center helping the more Luddite-ish of us learn how to
handle
catch up
with
the modern age.
Things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet you bring humor to that job, too.
Thank you so much, Sue.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
And
thanks.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez.